Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This half hour, we're going to discuss challenges for U.S. defense and security policy in the Middle East, including the continuing conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, the nuclear ambitions of Iran, and the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict, just to name a few. My guest is retired Army General John Abizaid. He was commander of the U.S. Central Command that CENTCOM during the crucial years of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Of course, Central Command oversees of those wars in a wide area of the world through the Middle East and beyond to Africa. My guest, General Abizaid, speaks today here at The Ohio State University, 3:30 this afternoon in the Film and Video Theater, free and open to the public. That's at the Wexner Center. And tonight at The Ohio Wesleyan University in Delaware at Great Chapel at 7:30 in the evening, free and open to the public as well. General John Abizaid, welcome to Open Line this half hour. Good to have you here.
Well, thanks, Fred. Good to be here.
And we're at 614-292-8513. We've got a half hour. Get your calls in pretty quickly, General Abizaid. So CENTCOM has responsibility for, what, over a quarter of a million troops and the theaters in Afghanistan and Iraq and Middle East and into Africa. This is quite a command.
Yeah, it's a very dynamic area. 27 different countries, half a billion people, primarily a Muslim part of the world, an area where terrorism is endemic, where a lot of different security problems exist, and of course where the all-important flow of oil has to be protected by our military forces.
Well, you've been called one of the chief architects of the war in Iraq, so I must ask you, we hear the surge is working. Certainly violence seems to be quelled just a bit. But beyond that, what's your outlook for the prospect of the future of Iraq in terms of the government getting together and doing the things it needs to do in terms of agreements and in terms of a possibility of a withdrawal of U.S. forces?
I certainly believe that the surge has made some immediate security improvements, and there's no doubt about that. Violence is down in a lot of different areas. There's been some good movement with regard to actions against al-Qaeda. There's been clearly some improvement in the Iraqi armed forces. So on the security realm, I think there's been good progress. It's less clear as to what's going on with regard to the governance. And, of course, you have to get this governance to come together in Iraq, where the Maliki government is able to represent all the people and not just the Shia. So I think it's still remained to be seen whether or not governance and economic development will keep pace with the security. We certainly bought some time. I think General Petraeus is doing a good job there and using the forces wisely, as is Ambassador Crocker, and trying to get other things organizing. But ultimately, this comes down to the Iraqis. Are they going to find a way forward to reconcile their differences or not?
Is it at all possible to talk about a timetable for withdrawal of U.S. forces, or is that unwise and premature?
I think timetables always get military commanders in trouble. And ultimately, if you get the military commander in trouble, you get the political leadership in trouble as well. So I think timetables are something that are very, very difficult to stick to, especially in a dynamic situation where you have a lot of outside forces trying to change the situation on the ground. So I'm not in favor of timetables, but I am in favor of making a clear statement that ultimately we intend to withdraw the vast majority of our troops. We've said that a number of times.
Yes.
That's what we want to do. And I think having that general goal is perfectly one that we can stand with.
Senator John McCain talked about 100 years as a possibility for our forces being in Iraq, and he qualified that by saying, assuming they're not being engaged in hostilities and being fired upon. Do we need a permanent military presence in Iraq?
Yeah, of course, as a soldier, I'm not going to comment on anything that that our political candidates are saying, but I'd say there will be a long-term presence in Iraq. The amount of time, it will be hard to say, and the long-term presence doesn't necessarily need to be a large military force. It could be a large training contingent. It could be an assistance mission of some sort. So I think that remains to be seen, but I would say that the combat forces over time will come down, and the training mission will increase, and that there will be a need for a close military relationship between the Iraqis and the United States in order to guarantee the success and the viability of a stabilizing country.
Is the United States building a number of what we would think of as permanent military bases in Iraq?
We have certainly some areas that are well-fortified, well-equipped, but I wouldn't consider them permanent on the way that in comparison to, say, our bases in Japan or Germany or other places around the world. And, of course, they could be made permanent, but it's a huge policy decision that the next president will have to make as to whether or not there's a degree of permanence in the relationship. I don't know how that's going to come out. It'll have to be policymakers that make that decision.
Are you optimistic about a future Iraq where there will be peace and security for the people of Iraq?
I'm optimistic that it can be done if we don't lose our patience and perseverance and courage. It's not one of these things that you can just immediately walk away from and then hope that it's going to all come together. You have to expend not only time and effort militarily, but you've got to invest in the place economically and diplomatically as well. So I think we can do it. We need more help from the other elements of our national power besides just the military. And I'm confident that can be done. And, of course, new president coming in January of 2009 will have their hands full.
Are combat forces generally in Iraq and Afghanistan, do you feel we're overextended? They've been back, some of them, for so many tours of duty, and they're very tired in many instances. Have we overextended them?
Yeah, certainly the combat forces are overextended. And I think just about every senior military leader has said that for about 2 years now. I certainly said it when I retired. It's clear that we're putting a huge burden on these young officers, these captains and majors and sergeant first classes and staff sergeants, the young people that are out there doing the fighting every day. I think of my own son-in-law, for example. He's got four tours of duty in the Middle East, one
four
in
now.
Afghanistan and three in Iraq, and he's got a wife and two kids at home. And he was wounded once besides that. So he's prepared to keep going, and the morale is relatively good, but the strain on the force is apparent. We just can't keep operating at these levels. I think ultimately we've got a national decision to make. We either are going to bring the forces down in the region or we're going to have to make the Army bigger. And there's not much choice other than those two.
Mm-hmm. How would we go about making the Army bigger? Would that be a draft?
No, I wouldn't think it would have to be a draft. I think we should not move back to the draft. I think we'd have to make some additional incentives to people to join. And we need to talk to people about why it's important to serve and why it's important to be dealing with these problems in the Middle East. The problems in the Middle East aren't just Iraq. They have a lot to do with the rise of al-Qaeda as a Sunni extremist group, the rise of Iran as a Shia extremist nation, the Arab-Israeli problem, and our continued dependence on oil. These four issues really drive our strategic rationale for being in the region. And whoever's president is going to have to deal with those issues. It's not a simple stay or go. It's how are we going to manage to shape the future so that you don't get the extremist ideology becoming mainstream out there.
We're talking with retired Army General John Abizaid. He was commander of the U.S. Central Command, that's CENTCOM, during the crucial years of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Central Command oversees a wide area of the world, including those wars and over a quarter of a million troops. General Abizaid, you're going to speak this afternoon at 3:30. Here at the Wexner Center for the Arts at the Ohio State University in the Film and Video Theater. I think we all know where the Wexner Center is around 15th and High in the Film and Video Theater. It's free and open to the public. You don't have to have a ticket, but seating is limited, so to guarantee your seat, you might want to arrive early. 3:30 in the Film and Video Theater at the Wexner Center for the Arts at 1871 North High Street at OSU. And General Abizaid, you'll also be speaking this evening at the Ohio Wesleyan University in Delaware, Ohio. 7:30 in the evening at Great Chapel on Sandusky Street. I think everybody in Delaware knows where Great Chapel is, 61 South Sandusky Street. That event is also free and open to the public. No tickets required, 7:30 this evening. We're at 614-292-8513 if you have a question for General John Abizaid. General Abizaid, you've been quoted as saying that we could live with a nuclear-armed Iran. Were you quoted correctly?
Yeah, we managed to live with the nuclear-armed Soviet Union without going to war with them, and it's not a nice thing to do, and it's certainly not the preferred course of action, but we shouldn't think that it's absolutely impossible to live with a nuclear Iran, and it changes the dynamics in the region. It also means that the Iranians will have to be put on clear notice that if they were to ever contemplate using a weapon, that it would result in their total destruction. It's just very, very clear, and you would hope that they understand that there's a curse to obtaining a nuclear weapon. It's just not something that provides power and influence. So could we live with them? Yeah. Should we do everything we can to prevent them from becoming a nuclear-armed country? Yeah. But before we say we can't live with it and we've got to go to war, I think we need to exhaust all avenues. It's very important that we explore avenues different than military force, especially with a country like that.
Tell me about the importance of employing avenues other than military force, you say, especially with a country like Iran.
Well, Iran is a very big country. It's a very mountainous country. It's also a country that's ruled by a very unpopular group of people. And so if you put too much pressure on the country, sometimes you end up solidifying the power base of those people that you want to leave. And I'm pretty confident that over time the good people of Iran will get tired of the Mullah rule and find a way to move forward and become a responsible nation again. I have no doubt about that. So the question is, how do you help that without strengthening the hands of the hardliners? And I believe we need to be very judicious in the way that we talk about using military power, always.
It's been reported that some elements at high levels of the Bush administration have talked about an air attack on suspected nuclear installations in Iran, and the reporter Seymour Hersh said that in The New Yorker that plans had been drawn up for that. Do you think that would be a wise or an unwise course of action?
Well, it all depends on the situation, obviously, how crucial the situation is with regard to threats to our friends in the region and to ourselves. But I think we should exercise caution in making threats about using military force. On the other hand, we should make it very, very clear to the Iranians that we are going to contain their power. We're not going to allow them to dominate the region, and we're going to do everything in our power to prevent them from obtaining a nuclear weapon. And as you know, Fred, we have a contingency plan for everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way things are in this modern world. And so that we have plans is not necessarily a reason to believe that we're going to put them into effect.
Although Seymour Hersh reported that the plans were more than the contingency plans, that they were active plans, being drawn up beyond contingency, at least according to his report.
Yeah, I really can't comment on that. I can only say that there's plans for a lot of different things, and it's important that we contain Iranian power in the region and make sure that the Iranians know that we're going to defend our friends and allies in the region and ensure that the flow of oil continues, not only for our good, but for the good of the global economy.
General John Abizade is with us. We're at 614-292-8513. Callers, make your questions concise so we can get to you before we close here. Mike is on the line. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Listen, I was a little disheartened to hear that you're against the draft. I mean, I think the draft is a great thing for this country. I really don't want to see our young men go off to war and get killed and everything, but if you look at a lot of the great empires, they started falling when they stopped enlisting their people and started conscripting them. In other words, if we have to pay a soldier to fight, then we all kind of sit back and say, oh, well, you know, somebody's going to out there and fight this battle for us. I mean, anything that we do, Iraq or anything that we do, we have to get the country behind it and get the country involved. And I think we're just kind of, we separate ourselves from what's going on over there because we know the only people over there are people who volunteered.
Okay, General Abizade, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I appreciate Mike's point of view. There's an awful lot of people that share his point of view. But you got to understand where my frame of reference is. My frame of reference is as a young officer who joined the draftee army at the end of the Vietnam War and watched us transition to the professional army and then see how the professional armed forces have been fighting this war over in the Middle East now for the last 7 years, essentially. And I can tell you there's never been a more professional or more capable force. So as a soldier, as a professional soldier, I want to keep the force professional. Now, in terms of national service, of encouraging people to serve in other ways, I believe that we should consider young people serving in all sorts of different ways, serve in State Department, serve in Doctors Without Borders, et cetera, in a way to help people help themselves out there in these difficult areas. But I am against deprofessionalizing the force by putting a short-term draft into place.
So a drafted army simply is not going to be as skilled as the army we have now.
Yeah, and you need to understand, we've been fighting now for 7 years and we've yet to lose a tactical battle in the field. That's a really remarkable achievement for any armed force. And so I think most professional military people want to keep it that way. On the other hand, we have to admit that we've got some strains out there and we've got to have the serious debate about whether or not we are ready to broaden the burden to the rest of the people.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. Kevin is next. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and thank you for coming on the show, General. I want to say I agree with the last caller, but that's aside from my point. My question is, regardless of what we want to do in Iran militarily, does it hurt or help our goals and any goals that we might have to not have diplomatic relations? So we haven't had them since 1979. And I was wondering what your thoughts were, General, on whether or not we should it's a good or a bad thing we don't, and if we should continue not to have official diplomatic relations with Iran.
Okay.
That's a terrific question. And, of course, now that I'm no longer on active duty, I can have a much different opinion. And my opinion is that we absolutely need to talk to people like the Iranians and people like the Syrians and any country out there we need to have a discussion with. It doesn't mean when you talk to them that you have to talk nice to them. We talked to the Soviet Union for most of its existence, and we were prepared to go to war and destroy the country within 20 minutes if necessary. So I think dialogues and opportunities for discussion are essential in the globalizing world. Diplomacy can save a lot of trouble if it's executed right. And the other thing that was very important to me as a military commander, I very much worried about miscalculation. Because we weren't talking with the Iranians, an incident on the border between the Iraq-Iran border, in the sea, on the Gulf Coast near the Shatt al-Arab, those sorts of things could quickly lead to very, very difficult circumstance, and you could end up having a war that nobody intends to have. So having lines of communication open that allow for an exchange of information and an opportunity to voice your views doesn't mean that you have to be nice to the person that you're, or to the group that you're talking to, but it does mean that you're able to avoid a lot of problems, which might really get you in deep trouble.
So, General, then in your view, the Bush administration should have been more active in diplomacy with Iran, Syria, and maybe other countries of the region as well.
Well, I would say my view is that we should be talking to the Iranians and the Syrians and everybody else in the region. There's no one in the world, when you're the world's number one power, that you shouldn't talk to. We talk to the North Koreans. That, you know, mm-hmm. Let's face it, we should talk to people that that we have an interest in talking to, and we have an interest in talking to. So you notice I did not say I disagree with the administration. I don't think that's a soldier's prerogative not to do.
Okay. The implication, however, is that, well, General, you've talked about a long war against Islamic extremists in the Middle East. What tell me about a long war.
Well, I think we really need to understand what's going on in particular with this ideology of Osama bin Laden. And it's an ideology that unfortunately has a lot of adherents in the region, certainly not the majority of the people by any stretch of the imagination, but it has a lot of committed people that are bent on removing American power from the region and ultimately dominating the region. It's an evil ideology. It's one that's implacably opposed to the United States and our values. And it's clear to me that you can fight them in the region or you can fight them in other places like London or New York or whatever else they may decide to do. They're global, they're borderless, they're networked, and they're capable of using military power in a way that a non-state actor has never really shown before. And they're dangerous. They need to be confronted. We need to continue to keep the pressure on al-Qaeda and its affiliates wherever we find them in order for our own safety and for the safety of the people of the world. And look, the good news is the vast majority of the people in the region don't want al-Qaeda to win.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to not lose sight of that. The goal needs to be help the people in the region have institutions that are robust enough to resist this extremism.
When you say a long war and continued pressure on al-Qaeda, would that be mostly very small? Are we talking here about police actions? Are we talking here about very small military actions for the most part? Because we're dealing with a small non-state actor.
I think ultimately you have to bring your military forces in the region down, but you have to have enough air and naval power to continue to protect the flow of oil. It's going to be essential for the globalizing planet. There's nobody else that can do that other than us. You have to have counter-terrorist forces to deal with al-Qaeda. But more importantly, you need to put forces that will build institutions and capability in countries such as Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Kenya, etc., so they can resist these various forces that are trying to tear down the global order. In many respects, the violence in the Middle East is all about a struggle for globalization. Is it going to globalize along the expected path, or is it going to globalize along the path that bin Laden and his ideology would like? And this ideology of bin Laden, is it's just not one or two people deep. You can take out bin Laden or Zawahiri in a day, and you'll still find out that the ideology will continue. So I think it's a generational problem. It's one that we can handle, but we shouldn't kid ourselves that it's going to be over with anytime soon.
In view of the fact, General, that these are non-state actors, and we're talking about long, long view here, do you think it was a diversion from this goal, this anti-terrorism goal, to go to war in Iraq?
I think the decision to go to war in Iraq, I don't know that I would call it a diversion. I would say it was a different part of the campaign. Despite the fact that you called me an architect, I never felt quite like an architect. I'm an executor of policy, okay, as opposed to being an architect of policy. And the decision to go to war was made by the President of the United States with advice of his folks, based on a lot of different reasons, some of which didn't really pan out, especially with regard to nuclear weapons in Iraq now, or the nuclear weapons program in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, I'd also tell you, we need not walk away from this issue of nuclear proliferation. It's the number one problem for us in the region. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. Pakistan's an unstable state. It's not out of the realm of probability that at some point during disorder that one of those weapons could fall into the hands of the extremists. And the extremists have made it very, very clear what they would want to do with it. So while I'm not saying we all need to get in the bomb shelters, I am saying we need to pay attention to this nuclear proliferation in the region, and we need to understand that this region will remain dangerous for a long time, and it will require a lot of American leadership and a lot of American help to build institutional capacity against extremism.
Mm-hmm. For 1 minute here on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it seems intractable. Could the U.S. be taking a more active role diplomatically here?
I think the president's done a great job in moving the ball forward here. It's pretty late in his administration to be doing it, but you always have to push forward in the Arab-Israeli arena to try to come up with a better solution than we've managed to come up with so far. You need to lessen the tensions, because the Arab-Israeli problem just causes people to lose hope. And when people lose hope, they start moving to the extremes. So going after al-Qaeda, containing Iran, moving the Arab-Israeli process forward, protecting the flow of oil, those four strategic goals are going to be part of whatever the new president faces in 2009. And figuring out how to deal with those goals will be central to the success of their presidency.
And these are goals over several generations.
They've been goals for several generations, and I'm afraid they'll continue to be goals. But we should be optimistic, because the vast majority of people out there really want to join the globalizing planet in a positive way. They want a better life for their kids, too. And we need to figure out how to make common cause with them, go after the people we need to go after, and then help the people we need to help.
Retired Army General John Abizaid, former commander of the U.S. Central Command, speaks this afternoon at 3:30 at the Film and Video Theater at the Wexner Center for the Arts here at The Ohio State University, right on High Street at 15th. The title of my guest address, Strategic Challenges in the Middle East, 3:30, free and open to the public. Just come, no tickets necessary. And then this evening in Delaware, Ohio, at Ohio Wesleyan University, Gray Chapel, right on Sandusky Street, 7:30 p.m. General John Abizaid, thank you so much for being with us on the show today.
Thanks, Fred. I enjoyed it.
And I did as well. And thank you. And when we come back, we're going to get an update on the political and humanitarian crisis in Kenya at WOSU 820 NPR News.
In commercial radio, in-depth means a minute 30. On much of public radio, you can hear stories stretched to 6 or 7 minutes. On Talk of the Nation, we're not talking in-depth until we've hit the half-hour mark. I'm Neil Conan. Take your time with the discussion on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation will be here later this afternoon at 2 o'clock. On today's Talk of the Nation, the political junkie Ken Rudin joins guest host Lynn Neary to talk about yesterday's Wisconsin primary and Hawaii's caucus. That's coming up at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820. And thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. It is about 20 degrees at 10:30. America's Ballroom Challenge is on WOSU-TV tonight at 8 p.m. Ballroom is back. Watch the field of contestants narrows once again on America's Ballroom Challenge on WOSU-TV. Don't miss this exciting display of competitive ballroom dancing. Again, that's on WOSU-TV tonight at 8 p.m. And thank you for joining us for Open Line. You can get a preview of Open Line guests and topics, and you can listen to archived episodes of Open Line on our website, wosu.org/openline. In the forecast for today, snow continues throughout the early afternoon, an accumulation of 1 to 2 inches, a high this afternoon of 25, the low tonight, 7 degrees.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This half hour on Open Line, we'll learn more about the political and humanitarian crisis in Kenya. Kenya, up to now, a reasonably stable nation on a hopeful journey to full democracy and an ally of the United States in fighting terrorism, a principal ally, many say. But following a disputed presidential election in December, more than 1,000 people have died in political and ethnic conflict, and hundreds of thousands, perhaps up to 600,000 people, have been forced from their homes. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice visited Kenya on Monday, attempting to broker a power-sharing agreement between rival political parties in the hope of ending the violence and restoring stability to Kenya, but that agreement has not been reached as of this hour. To tell us more about the continuing crisis in Kenya, joining us this half hour, Joel Barkin is Senior Associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, and he's Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Professor Barkin served as an observer in the recent disputed Kenyan presidential election last December. Welcome, Joel Barkin, to Open Line. Good to have you here.
Nice to be with you, Fred.
And joining us in our studios, Kennedy Waliaula is a graduate teaching associate in the Department of Comparative Studies here at The Ohio State University. He was a television news anchor and a prominent novelist in his native Kenya. Kennedy, good to have you here as well.
Thank you very much.
And we're at 614-292-8513. Let me go first to Joel Barkin. Joel, the names may not mean much to Americans, President-elect Kibaki, opposition leader Odinga, but how do we get from a potentially stolen election to this horrific violence with so many displaced and so many dying? There's much more going on here than an election, is that right?
There is more going on than an election. The election was the trigger, but the election was flawed. And it's important to remember, or for the audience to understand, that going into the election, a series of public opinion polls going all the way back to about 3 months before the election predicted that Raila Odinga would be the winner, although the margin of victory narrowed as the polls approached.
Mm-hmm. And he was
Everybody
the challenger.
Knew this
yeah.
would be a very close election, and therefore it was absolutely necessary that the election be run on a free and fair basis so that the losers would accept the outcome. That didn't occur, and consequently, the explosion.
Mm-hmm. We hear people driving other people from the homes, people of different ethnic groups in the same town. There was a chilling report on the BBC the other day in which a reporter said to some young men in a town in Kenya, "What will you do if your neighbors who are from a different ethnic group return to your town?" And they replied very coldly, "Well, of course, we will kill them." What engenders this kind of hatred and this kind of violence?
Well, this is as a result of the anger which came from the way that the election was conducted. The anger has been intensifying by the day. There's so much damage done. The inter-ethnic sentiments of hatred have continued to grow. This is something that has been simmering. It's not surprising. Mm-hmm. It has roots in history, Kenyan's history. You think about the time of the colonial administration when the British decided to divide and then rule. And therefore, suspicion has always already there between the different language groups.
Between the
yes.
The British encouraged this or promoted
yes.
this.
Yes, they did not encourage mixing of people from different backgrounds. They put them in what were called reserves, so that the Kikuyu remained in central Kenya and the Luo remained in western Kenya. And the same applies to the more than 42 different ethnic groups. So what happened is that after independence, the first post-colonial government of Jomo Kenyatta did not deviate from the British norm. It saw the divide-and-rule policy as a good way of maintaining its control of the population. And the regime that followed, the Moi regime, went one further, in intensifying this policy of dividing people and ruling. But I think the height of all this is when Kibaki came to power in the last 5 years, when he showed very open discrimination and made things worse by stealing an election.
Mm-hmm. Joel, you observed that election, and I guess the conducting of the election in terms of people being allowed to vote and show up at the polls was fine, but it was in the count on the election that there became a problem?
That was indeed the problem. Everybody had high hopes for this election. This was going to be the fourth multi-party election since 1992, when multi-party politics was reintroduced in Kenya after a lapse of almost a quarter of a century, and those early elections in 92 and 97 were flawed elections, unlevel playing fields for the candidates. This time around, things went relatively well. The two major candidates and minor ones, and also candidates for parliamentary office, were free to campaign. There was some harassment, but by and large, everything went well in the run-up to the election. The Electoral Commission of Kenya did a much better job in terms of providing the necessary logistics so that the polls opened on time. Everybody who really wanted to vote was able to vote, at least in the areas that I observed and those observed by other international observers. And the count at the polling station went well. Indeed, it was moving to watch. I watched a poll out in a rural polling station about 15 miles west of Nakuru under a gas lamp. It was very transparent. The agents of the various parties all signed off. Everything was good up through that point. The thing fell apart in the reporting of the results from the polling stations back to the headquarters at the constituency level, and in turn from there, from the constituency level headquarters back to the central headquarters of the Electoral Commission of Kenya. The reporting of the vote was delayed by 2 days, and by the 48 hours after the election, when contradictory results were being released on Kenyan TV, one knew that indeed there was some considerable fiddling going on, and that the outcome would be suspect. And as I indicated at the outset, in a close election, everything has to be near perfect if the losers are going to accept the results, especially, as I might have said at the opening, the electorate was very much divided along ethnic lines for the reasons Kennedy indicated. Two different ethnic coalitions, candidates campaigning on ethnic messages, also the use of text messaging through cell phones that engendered a certain amount of animosity towards opposition groups. And so you had this this boil, shall we say, that then exploded as a result of the fiddling with the result.
Mm-hmm. And Joel, you said that you suspect that President-elect Kibaki really was not elected, huh?
I've said that in my Senate testimony. I would say that he was not elected. This does not mean that Raila Odinga was elected, because there are some indications of malfeasance on the opposition side as well. But most of it appears to have occurred on the on the side of the government, basically by inflating the vote from those areas of the country, namely Central Province, from which the president comes. And the international observer groups, the main one being the that of the European Union, called for an international forensic audit. I think that's basically the position of the United States now, and probably to the extent that we can ever determine exactly when what went wrong. That should be pursued even at this late date.
Mm-hmm. We're getting an update on and in-depth discussion here of the situation in Kenya, the continuing crisis. Joel Barkin, senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington and professor emeritus of political science at the University of Iowa. You see, he is an observer in the recently disputed Kenyan election. Kennedy Waliaula is joining us in the studio. He's a graduate teaching associate here at The Ohio State University. He was a television news anchor and a prominent novelist in his native Kenya. We're at 614-292-8513 if you'd like to join the conversation. Kennedy, when we hear that so many people are displaced from their homes and forced from their homes in many cases by members of other language groups and asked to leave or forced to leave their villages and towns and have wound up elsewhere, is this something that Kenya is going to easily recover from? Because people, apparently, at least according to reports I have read, are not moving back to their original towns and villages. They're staying away from them in fear of their lives. How's Kenya ever going to come back together again?
This is a huge problem that will probably take a very long time to solve. People have seen their neighbors hacked to death. They've seen their houses burned. And if they have survived it, it's unlikely that they would want to go back, partly because they are unsure that the government is either willing or able to protect them if they are to return to the areas that they lived before. But the government has been rather blind to the situation because it's been calling on people in the camps to return to their homes, even made attempts to dissolve some of those camps, which seems to indicate a sense of insensitivity to the plight of these internally displaced people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when I hear things like this and we say people hacked to death, houses burned, hundreds of thousands displaced, the word Rwanda comes to my mind, and I begin thinking about what is the potential for something much worse than what has already happened in Kenya?
As the situation has unfolded since December, the kind of violence that has escalated has involved the lower classes, the poor, who have, you could say, nothing to lose. There are many jobless young men who are very disenchanted, even with their own lives. And the situation was fertile for this kind of reaction because of their sense of despair. If you look at it, willing to do any damage. So my fear is that because the government is showing unwillingness even to yield ground and allow for a more settled understanding as far as the situation is concerned, you fear that perhaps something in the way of Rwanda may come. Kenya has been living under the illusion that it's an island of peace in an area that is largely volatile.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, Kenyans used to talk about themselves as being special while the neighbors were bleeding and burning. They felt that this is a country that can never have this kind of situation. But I remember working in the media in 2002 when the international media expected that the election would turn violent and the Moi regime was ending and the Kibaki regime was beginning, the way that things turned out is that there was some kind of disappointment by the international media. The media expected there to be violence that time. Then there was no violence. But I always felt, even when I did my commentary on radio and television that time, I say that this is not necessarily the beginning of a new dawn for Kenya. That's the 2002 multi-party election in which, for the first time, the governing KANU party lost. I said perhaps people are putting too much hope in the Moi, post-Moi era. And it turns out, really, that, in fact, the coalition that won that election was made up of Kibaki and Odinga, who are now at war, in a sense.
They were allies at that
yes.
point.
Yeah. In fact, they are so incompatible in the ways of working that they could not coexist. And there was a fallout so that Kibaki remained in government, and a majority of Raila supporters with Raila himself formed the ODM, the Orange Democratic Movement. So my fear is that even as the talks continue, and Raila seems to be yielding a little bit, the awareness of a deliberate stealing campaign by the government makes it unlikely to envision a situation where they will perhaps reach a settlement or even work together. If they reach that settlement, they don't seem to be compatible at all.
Joel Barkin, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, was Monday in Kenya talking to President-elect Kibaki and the opposition leader Raila Odinga. But at least as I've heard so far, they've not been willing to come to some sort of real power-sharing agreement. Do you think the Kibaki regime will ever agree to actual power-sharing?
It's not clear that they will. I want to say one thing before I get to Rice about the comment about Rwanda. Kenya may not be completely different from other African countries, but it is different, and it's certainly different from Rwanda, and this is not genocide that's going on. We must remember that there were only over 800,000 people
Yes.
killed in Rwanda, whereas in Kenya, while 1,000 is horrific enough, this is pales by comparison. Genocide is state-sponsored violence. That's not what is going on here, although there are politicians who are encouraging militias and gangs and the type of people, the unemployed that Kennedy talked about, to commit some of these atrocities. As for a political solution, power sharing is indeed what is required here, precisely to deal with the fact that Kenya is composed of 42 ethnic groups, some of which have had a disproportionate share of both political power and economic power through the course of its history, particularly the Kikuyu, the largest ethnic group in the country with 22% of the population, the most educated group, the group that's dominated the civil service and business community, and the group that is from which President Kibaki comes from and which is holding on to power now. What does power sharing mean? There are basically at least three ingredients to this for any power sharing deal. First, is going to involve much more than simply a government of national unity. As Kennedy mentioned, President Kibaki and Raila Odinga have been in government before, so giving a few cabinet posts to Odinga's people is not really going to solve the problem here. Rather, there needs to be the sharing of power with separate responsibility that spreads power out across the representatives of the different major ethnic groups. That means, first of all, a diminution or a reduction of presidential power, an end to the imperial presidency in Kenya, which is really a hangover from the one-party era, more power to the legislature, so there's a greater balance between the executive branch and the legislative branch, where Raila Odinga's party has a near majority. And secondly, there will probably have to be some form of devolution, that is, a shifting of power away from the central government to government at the district level or some form of regional government. This is known as Majimbo in Kenya. It is a highly emotive term that divides people. That term is probably best not used, but shifting power to some subnational form of government which accommodates each of the major ethnic groups, the type of constitutional change that occurred in India, for example, in 1956 and which later occurred in Nigeria. And finally, there has to be a complete revamping of the Electoral Commission and electoral procedures to guarantee the independence of that commission, because there's no point having another election in Kenya if you're going to have flawed results as occurred this time around. The procedures that allowed for the fiddling of the vote, those loopholes basically have to be closed before any future poll can take place.
Mm-hmm. So, Kennedy, this kind of power sharing and this kind of federalism to give so many different language groups some kind of say and some kind of voice and some kind of future sounds like it might be essential for Kenya.
I am not sure that that is going to work, because the thing is that if that kind of arrangement comes into place, it may mean that some people will not be allowed by those who misunderstand that kind of arrangement to live in areas where they are not the dominant people, so that the Kikuyu perhaps would have difficulties living in Kisumu, which is a Luo-dominated area, one conception of the Majimbo system is that, yeah, it means exclusive habitation of certain areas by certain groups. And this is potentially dangerous. It may mean more polarization and balkanization of the country. Whatever good intents and purposes accompany this kind of arrangement, it's still potentially problematic. And what I was thinking is that what we have in Kenya, the real problem with in Kenya, even as Achebe talked about his own native Nigeria, is simply the problem of lack of leadership. You can't look on any side, the opposition side or the government side, without seeing a repository of leaders of integrity who can bring people together. And sadly, even the religious organizations do not seem to offer any help. They were absolutely partisan in the wrangles and violence that erupted, and therefore they have lost the moral ground to be able to bring people together. The media has always taken sides and intensified and exacerbated the situation. We have private media in Kenya, but the media again decides who to support and sometimes hide some things under the carpet rather than objectively tell people exactly what is happening, so that you fear that there could even be radio that is used to incite some other people against others, as the situation was in Rwanda. But I want to, having said that, add that perhaps, as Joel said, we haven't reached that level of the Rwandan genocide yet. Only that we do not know about the future. One just hopes that some sense will prevail.
Kennedy, you say there's a paucity of leadership on all sides in Kenya. In that event, given that, how would the situation improve? By what means?
I think my suggestion is that as at now, neither of the two sides really will be able to bring together that sense of national cohesion. If there can be a system of bringing some kind of transition government, a government that, while it is in power, will ensure that the constitution is changed to accommodate a new dispensation that will bring a level playing ground, and then at the same time to ensure that institutions work and institutions are respected. Joel has talked about the Electoral Commission, which was made up prior to the election by people who were essentially Kibaki supporters, apart from...
Supporters of the president-elect.
Yes, yeah. Because he did it single-handedly, hand-picked people and put them on the commission, knowing that they were going to work for him rather than for the Kenyan people. So if you can have a system in which even the courts are free from government interference, then you can be sure that people will respect those institutions, as the case was in the U.S. when Al Gore and George W. Bush seems to have been in a situation similar to what we see between Raila Odinga and Mwai Kibaki. But the American people respected the institutions. That's why they accepted the results when the court decided who it thought was the winner. But people in Kenya do not have respect for the institutions because of the interference that has always been a part and parcel of the way things are done.
Joel, you'd like to add something here.
Yeah, I think Kennedy is basically correct here. That is to say, institutions are the key and the basis for democratization, not simply individuals. But 2 points I'd like to make, and that is, first of all, the record of Mwai Kibaki on the economic side was actually very good, and he delivered on the economic front more than any other president since Jomo Kenyatta over 30 years ago. Rate of economic growth was up to about 7%. Agriculture had come back, 12% growth in agriculture production last year, which was widespread across all economic and ethnic groups. Tourism booming again. The problem was, going back to a comment that Kennedy made at the beginning, is that Kibaki basically ruled from essentially his own ethnic base. Instead of creating a broad-based government, he relied on a small handful of advisors from his own ethnic group. And also, I think it's important to point out people of his own age cohort who are in their mid-70s. There are a lot of younger Kikuyu who have been very upset with him by the fact that he didn't reach out and indeed committed the same mistake as Jomo Kenyatta did 30 years before, essentially a government perceived by non-Kikuyu as a Kikuyu-only government despite the fact that it performed well. That laid the basis for the election. As for the leadership, the sad fact of the matter is, or perhaps simply just the reality, is that the political class has indeed failed Kenyans, but that's the political class that Kenyans have in terms of their elected politicians, and it's those people who have to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. One bright side of this whole tragedy, and in marked contrast with Uganda or Rwanda certainly, or most other African countries, is that there is a large and important civil society in Kenya, a middle class, and a broad group of professionals and business people who do want to see accommodation here. And one of the frustrating aspects of the current standoff is that those people, including many businessmen who are of the same ethnic group as President Kibaki, are having a very difficult time breaking through to the hardliners around the president to have them become more flexible in negotiations with Raila Odinga. And there are also hardliners around Odinga. So a struggle is going on, not only between the two factions of the political class, but shall we say the political class that is tone deaf to a, shall we say, a broad professional middle class element in Kenyan society that is in effect trying to calm matters and encourage negotiations. And I would say that with that group is probably the source of hope if Kenya comes out of this standoff. And likewise, if that group was not there, Kenya might well have fallen off the brink by now.
We have time for, just before we close, for a couple of quick comments or questions from our listeners. Zax is with us with a comment. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, Fred, how are you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I think Ken and Joe have pretty much said what I was going to say, but I think the most important thing here is for the international community to keep this pressure on Kenya, because obviously those two leaders are irreconcilable based on the positions they have taken. So I think if Kofi Annan and Dr. Rice and the other international communities have the presence in Kenya, continue to do what they're doing right now, I think it'd be very helpful. Very quickly here on the leadership issue, Kibaki did very well economically, but he failed as a leader because that Mandela style of leadership was not in him. He has been in the State House for a long time, or around that for a long time. It was just obvious that after having served for 5 years, it could have been better for him just to step aside and let that economic progress that we had achieved that Joe talked about a while ago continue with a new leader. Mm-hmm. So I think as a Kenyan, I'm ashamed. We're ashamed, of course. We were shocked. I was there during that time that this election took place, and it turned out to be a disaster. And I think we blame squarely the President Kibaki for his unwillingness to reach out and accept defeat for that reason. But the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that we hope to start down the road, I think, will help us in finding out the root causes of these things, which are more than just the election.
All right.
I think Ken and Joe have talked about a lot about this, so I would just, you know, listen to their comments off the air.
And I thank you for calling. We must close now. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all our callers, but we have been enlightened here by our guests, Kennedy Waliaula, graduate teaching associate in the Department of Comparative Studies at OSU, television news anchor, prominent novelist in his native Kenya. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Joel Barkin, senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, professor emeritus of political science at the University of Iowa. Thank you for being with us this half hour as well.
Nice to be with you.
When we come back, policy analysts who are visiting Columbus say it would be folly to launch a military attack against Iran. This is at listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.